I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, most people are simultaneously animal lovers and animal eaters. Is that conflict a problem? Does being a meat eater cause psychological stress because it means being part of a violent system of slaughtering creatures? Or is there such a thing as being an ethical meat consumer? We're going to hear the moral argument against being a meat eater. And later on The Source, the San Antonio Food Bank is ramping up to respond to a historic need. Local federal workers are not getting paychecks. Families that depend on SNAP won't have that resource. How the food bank is gearing up to keep hunger at bay and how you can help. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Tired of spending so much time and money on vehicle maintenance and repairs? Make this October Cartover when you donate a car, truck, or RV to TPR. Visit tpr.careasy.org or call 877-486-1227 to get started.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In Texas, meat isn't just food, it's identity. It's a lifestyle. From backyard barbecues to stock shows, brisket cook-offs to Sunday carnitas, the culture of meat runs deep here. And what if our devotion to it, though, rests on something that we just don't want to see? A new book argues that the act of eating meat depends on a kind of collective self-deception, a psychological and moral blind spot that lets us deny the suffering behind what's on our plate. Philosopher John Sabonmatsu, a professor at Worcester Polytech Institute, calls this the omnivore's deception. His new book is The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat Animals and Ourselves. He explores how we build elaborate moral and cultural systems to hide the violence of animal agriculture from ourselves, even as it contributes to climate change, deforestation, and the suffering of billions of sentient beings each year. And John Sabonmatsu, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
So these are fighting words in Texas.
Imagine.
You believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that humanity must end all animal consumption and abolish the animal economy entirely, right?
That is absolutely the case. I don't, I've been studying this issue for 40 years and I'm a philosopher, and I've yet to come up against a single good argument for anything that we're doing to other animals. I mean, we're killing about 80 billion land animals every year, mostly mammals and birds in the food economy. And then at sea, we're killing up to 2.7 trillion marine animals. And the thing is, none of this violence is necessary, and I argue at length in my book, I think, pretty persuasively why it's wrong, and in fact, the greatest social justice issue of our time.
And you also used the word evil to describe this process.
You know, if you read around these issues, like the meat economy, animal rights, veganism, and so forth, I think there's a tendency to trivialize what we do to other animals. But as I explain, the kinds of harm that we routinely inflict on all of these beings, as you said, sensitive beings, if we were enacting these kinds of harms against humans, we would describe them as war crimes, atrocities, or even genocide. And I know those words may seem really strong, but given that we're putting animals even on our organic farms and gas chambers, baby pigs are picked up by their hind legs if they're not growing fast enough and their brains are dashed in. I mean, I could give so many examples, and this is just the routine stuff. So I think it's, typically at the most, people think, well, maybe there's some ethical issue here or maybe it's wrong. But no, I argue that it is a form of radical evil. It's as evil as anything that we do to one another.
Well, listeners, if you think that's correct or incorrect, you want to challenge that, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So obviously the title, Omnivores, Deception, you're working off another book, Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivores, was it the...
Dilemma.
Dilemma, that's correct. Okay, so, and he was saying, he's arguing that there is such a thing as clean meat and ethical eat consumption, meat consumption, and you're saying that's just not, he's being deceptive.
Yes, I mean, there are different forms of deception, really, I take up. In my book, the most obvious is what the meat, egg, dairy, fishing industries do to propagandize us, to keep us addicted to these products, which are contraindicated with survival on this planet. Just the most destructive ecological force on the earth is animal agriculture and fishing put together. So, you know, through television commercials and behavior modification, et cetera, these industries do that. But there are a couple other ways that we're being deceived. One is, as you suggest, through this discourse of humane meat, sustainable meat, and animal products that has been sustained by a number of people for the last couple decades. Now, Michael Pollan's book came out in 2006, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and was followed the next year by Barbara Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle. I'm sure that your listeners are familiar with Temple Grandin. She's another contributor to this discourse. And the idea is that if we just have smaller farms and we treat the animals well, there's no moral problem. But if you think about how we're going to get feed 8 to 10 billion humans every year, feed them the bodies of trillions of animals who, by the way, are cognitively sophisticated. They have very complex emotions, and this is all scientific fact. How we're going to get billions and trillions of animals to wind up dead without causing them extreme violence and suffering it's simply ludicrous. So yes, I spend a few chapters taking apart this myth of humane meat and regenerative animal agriculture and so forth. And then finally, there's self-deception involved, which is to say what the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre called bad faith, which is simply that we don't want to acknowledge the terrible harms that we're inflicting. And quite in contradiction to our usual sensibilities. I mean, most people who eat animal products think of themselves as animal lovers, or at least they don't want to inflict harm on other sensitive beings, and yet they're participating in the system. And so they come up with all these rationales to defend their choices. But as I say, I don't believe those choices are defensible.
Well, I mean, I'm hung up on the deception issue. I think that is really the point that we ought to discuss. Whether or not people decide to eat meat or not, that's something that, you know, people are going to do. But I think we can talk about how aware they should be about the literal making of the sausage. That's, you know, typically that people, they want the sausage, but they don't want to see how it's made. But if we inform people, this is where your meat comes from. You pick it up at the grocery store in this nice, clean little packet. You don't really, they don't have a picture of Elsie on there and saying, this was the animal that this meat came from. You should know more about, you know, how this meat came here. Do you think that would make a difference?
Well, it's a really good question. It would make a difference, but it wouldn't be decisive. And the reason is we're acculturated to think of other beings as our inferiors and to see their lives as essentially worthless. Now, that may sound like a strong statement, but we couldn't be killing trillions of animals every year unless we thought that they were worthless. So, you know, like if I show my students films like Meet Your Meat, which I recommend, some of them get very upset, but some of them have been trained to see animals like everybody else as kind of animate machines almost, rather than as I said, you know, cognitively and emotionally complex beings. People don't understand or realize or want to realize that cows, chickens, pigs, and so forth are just as intelligent, just as emotionally sensitive as our own cats and dogs. we have a kind of anthropocentric and narcissistic view of cats and dogs that somehow they're special, their consciousness is special. But it's not the case.
Right. We'll talk more about that. We've got to hit this break.
Yeah.
We'll get some callers. Jimmy and Jeff will get you on the air on this conversation. We come back. The Omnivore's Deception, John Senbonmatsu on The Source. When we come back, stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies. Millions of Americans see themselves as conflicted omnivores, worrying about the ethical and environmental implications of their choice to eat animals. Yet their attempts to justify their choices only obscure the truth of the matter. We're speaking with John Senbonmatsu. His new book is The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. And let's go to a caller. And the number is 833-877-8255. And Jimmy, you're on the air. Jimmy, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I would ask your guest if he was sitting face-to-face with a Holocaust survivor, like one that I've had in my family, would he equate that person's experience with what a dairy cow goes through to put, you know, a glass of milk in my fridge? And secondly, how does he answer the question that the vast majority of these animals would not exist but for their preparation for food? And I'll take my comments off the air, or the answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Well, Jimmy, thank you for that question. And John, I know that your father, he was in the Japanese internment camps here in the United States. And yes. Your mother is Jewish. This resonates.
Yes. And I understand where Jimmy's question is coming from, and I share his sensitivity. I mean, I teach genocide studies partly at my workplace. I've written on the topic. I've studied fascism at length. I am not the first person to compare what we do to other animals, by the way, to genocide. One of the first people to do that was actually the great Yiddish writer Isaac Bashevis Singer, who won the Nobel Prize in Literature. And it was Singer who compared in a story that was published in The New Yorker decades ago called The Letter Writer. He compared what we do to animals to an eternal Treblinka. Treblinka, of course, being one of the most notorious of the Nazi concentration camps. Jacques Derrida, one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century, French philosopher, also spoke of our genocide against other animals. And yes, it could give a lecture on the parallels in terms of the techniques, the degradation of victims in human-to-human genocide and in terms of what we do to other animals. I mean, the scale of the violence is simply what's the most important, I think, distinction. So the reason that we get upset when we hear someone like me say, oh, my goodness, it's what we're doing to animals is similar to genocide, the only reason we get upset about that is because of how worthless we think other animals are. And I talk about that discourse of worthlessness and how the Nazis, for example, in the T4 euthanasia program, they began murdering disabled children and adults. This was before the Jewish Holocaust got underway, on grounds that there are certain forms of life that are simply worthless and you should give them a humane death. And we find the same discourse being recycled today by Michael Pollan and many other critics.
So, I mean, animals... I'm an animal, as a human animal, but there is a huge gap between a human person and a non-human person animal, isn't there?
Not according to Charles Darwin. I mean, in 1871, he published The Descent of Man, and he denies that there are qualitative distinctions to be drawn between humans and other animals. Now, we can and must acknowledge that there actually are some qualitative distinctions that matter for a variety of reasons, but we can't deny the qualitative continuities of consciousness and behavior, subjectivity, and indeed personhood that we find between humans and other animals. I mean, that's simply part of evolutionary biology. Darwin wrote a whole book on the emotions in man and other animals, or man and animals, as he called it. And this is simply scientific fact that other animals are capable of PTSD, of psychosis, of they have memories they get attached to and love their young, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, anyone who's lived with their cat or dog knows that they're persons. They're not people.
Well, they're not persons. They're dogs and cats.
Well, no, there's a very active region of animal ethics that talks about personhood in other species. So whether and that's okay if people get are hung up on that term person, that's fine, but they're someones. Let's just say they're someones. They're consciousnesses, they're subjects.
Sure.
And therefore their interests ought to be taken into account, including their interest in not being subjected to extreme violence, which is what killing
them is. So is it wrong for me to have a dog, my dog Hoppy? Is that wrong?
How do you mean? Is it
happening? I mean, I have a dog.
Yeah.
I take care of him. We go walking together several times a day. I mean,
he's
not free and running through the woods, but, you know, he's my pet.
Well, I mean, I think the question, you know, with anybody who keeps a dog or cat is, you know, are you keeping your dog out of love for that dog because you want what's best for the dog? And I would suspect yes, right? That's different from raising your dog in order to kill your dog and skin your dog and take the fur of your dog, right? I mean, because your whole relationship would be one of instrumentalism, of domination. So that's a good model, though, the way you're relating to your dog out of love and compassion, and tell me if I'm wrong, but a kind of respect. That's how we should treat all the animals of this planet.
Okay, and, so I'm going to go to another caller really quick, because you're a philosopher. You can talk forever. I'm going to try and get some callers, if that's okay. Okay, let's go to Jeff. And Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, I live out west of San Antonio. I shoot 2 deer a year, and I make sausage and chili meat and all that. When I shoot a deer, they never know what hit them. So they don't suffer when they die. They don't see it coming. And I end up eating the meat. Now, in Medina County where I live, there are tons of deer, and if nobody shot deer and thinned them out, they would become overpopulated. They wouldn't have enough food to eat. And when they would become inbred, it's part of the balance of nature to kill some animals off so the others can be stronger.
All right, Jeff, thank you for the call. So, John, he's not buying a package of meat at the grocery store. He's out there. You know, there's very little between him. You know, he kills the animal and then he eats it. So what deception's there?
Well, it's absolutely not necessary to kill and eat animals. I mean, it's not even the healthiest way to have a human diet. That's simply a fact. I mean, you can read articles in The Lancet or JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, on this topic that you know, vegans live longer, they suffer lower rates of heart disease, cancer, stroke, and so on. So, you know, why go out into the woods to inflict extreme harm, violence against this other being? Why do that unless you enjoy it, unless you want to do that, which is a kind of sadism? The reason that considered too many deer in some regions or local communities is because humans, speaking of the balance of nature, have killed off all the predators through hunting. That's why that's happening. And rather than seek nonviolent means for controlling the deer population, we resort immediately to violence. And that's what I'm questioning. Last thing I'll say is, I'll just point out that there's only one species on this earth whose overpopulation and development has endangered every other form of life on this planet, and that is our species. And yet no one talks about culling us, thinning our herd, going after real estate developers or CEOs of powerful corporations who are literally destroying the means of life on this planet. And I'm not advocating violence against them, absolutely not. But I'm just noting the hypocrisy of saying, well, these animals are expendable, their lives don't matter, we're going to go out and kill these without taking a look in the mirror.
Okay. I'm going to go to Aaron on the phones. And Aaron, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. This is a great topic. I've thought about this many times over my life, and it touches on something that's important to me, which is that it's all about awareness, right? So as I've gotten older, I've become more aware of the living things around me. And I'm at a point in my life now where I understand and believe, for me personally, that we're here to serve the living things. So in from that thread, I can identify with the gentleman that's speaking. But then I would say he's touching on subjects like intelligence, right, and consciousness. And then, and he's also talking about science, right? So when we start looking at these things, we see that our awareness has grown over time. So we're now aware of this. And so he's saying, you know, we should address this.
Okay.
Well, if you look at the science, you'll see that they're now starting to realize that fungi and plants have neurons and have the intelligence to communicate with each other.
Okay.
So if that's communication and that's intelligence, then are we going to stop cutting potatoes up, and are we going to stop eating plants?
All right. So, Aaron, let me get to that because we're really short on time. So, John, what about, I mean, why limit it to just animals?
Well, thank you, caller, Aaron, for this. This is one of many different red herring arguments that are thrown up kind of to blind us to the facts here. There is actually no evidence that fungi, plants have subjective first-person experiences, what we normally call consciousness. I address this in my book. It's simply not the case. Whereas we know for a fact that mice and rats and bonobo chimps and so forth have memories, they have relationships, they're susceptible to trauma, vulnerable to harm in ways that plants and fungi simply aren't. So no, it is not the same thing. These are qualitatively different kinds of beings, and therefore they have different kinds of interests. I just urge people to read my book with an open mind, and I don't think people who are able to take the time to read it will come away unpersuaded, or at least it will challenge some of their myths that they've been brought up with.
Sure. So that's why I wanted to talk to you, not so much to convince people to stop eating meat, but at least think about it. Consider where you are. You know, Michael Pollan says we're top of the food chain, and so we have this ability or right or, you know, privilege to eat meat, and you disagree with that. Do you not see that we're part of the food chain, or how do you see that working?
Well, I address this in the first part of my first chapter, that this idea that it's natural to eat meat. It's no more natural to eat meat than to download Netflix or to come up with a tax policy. These are cultural practices. We're not at the top of a food chain. What we're doing is we're tearing up the food web.
Let me challenge you on that really quickly, because we're so short on time. If I took a human being and put them in a natural environment and told them go forth and multiply, wouldn't they turn to eating meat? Wouldn't that be natural?
No, I mean, there are many different things people would do in situations of desperation and deprivation. It's what we call lifeboat ethics, right? I mean, there are people, cannibalism has been practiced in many human cultures for thousands of years. That's not a reason. Just because we can naturally metabolize human flesh isn't a reason to do it, to kill and eat our neighbor, right? So, no, there's nothing. Jane Goodall just died. Was she unnatural for being a vegan and advocating universal veganism? Was Leonardo da Vinci acting unnaturally by being an ethical vegetarian? Or Tolstoy, or, you know, all these other people?
Yeah, we all watched Paul McCartney the other day here in San Antonio.
McCartney, for sure. Yeah, and I don't think this should be a choice. You're saying, well, it should be left up to the individual. Well, you know, in a certain sense, no, because in the same way that I don't think that, you know, assaulting people should be left up to the individual, that this is a great crime that's occurring, and we need to reexamine it, not as individuals, but as a society, as a species, and say, look, there's a better way to live on this planet than by committing mass violence against billions, trillions of beings every year. Simply is a better way to be a human being.
Do you see this idea actually gaining traction? Do you think that this movement will catch on?
Well, my friend, if you look at what's going on in the news, right, with the destruction of the ecosystem, fascism rising, our democracy on the ropes, and so forth, I would just ask in general, you know, are we doing well? You know, do we have the kinds of institutions and forms of society and culture and economics that we need to have a world that's worth living in? And the answer is no. So I'm a pessimist for a variety of reasons on this issue and others. But what I'm saying is this is a critically important issue, and it's tied in with all these other issues. I mean, it's not an accident that MAGA is all over the quote carnivore diet. that in the manosphere they talk about nothing but eating meat as a form of masculine virility.
And red meat politics, we hear about that all the time.
Yes, red meat politics, yeah. So these issues are tied together, and at the bottom of it is the idea of natural dominion, natural domination. Men are meant to dominate women. Certain races are meant to dominate other races. We're meant to dominate and harm the other beings of this earth. These are ideas. They're bad ideas. They're anachronistic ideas. They've been around, kicking around for thousands of years. Right. So we need to let go of them.
And we need to think about ideas. Let's just talk about ideas, so at least. John Sanbonmatsu, thank you so much for talking to us today. The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.